an inherent duty for government, the EMS industry, and all personnel involved at EMS at all levels to identify threats and find ways to reduce their impact, and fully embrace a culture of safety in EMS. To begin to do that, though, we must be able to quantify the problem.
That was Dia Gaynor, State Director of EMS for Idaho and recent chair of the National EMS Advisory Council, a council created in 2006 by the Secretary of Transportation, Mary Peters, to involve members of the EMS community in the development of federal EMS programs. Welcome once again to another installment of the MSARN Monthly Podcast we like to call I'm Just an Ambulance Driver. In this month's podcast, we take a close look at safety culture. Now, safety is extremely important to everyone in EMS, but many of us may not know what is meant by safety culture. Now, we have good reason to be concerned about safety in EMS. EMTs and paramedics work in an unpredictable environment, and calls for help can come at any time. We don't often know what to expect once on scene, and we are often exposed to violence, a high risk of needle stick injuries, back injuries, and high amounts of work-related stress. Several studies by McGuire, Reichard, Suyama, and others show that the rate of death and rate of non-fatal injuries for EMTs are among the highest in the country. Studies led by Rittenberger, Wang, and others reveal that EMS is not immune from medical errors or adverse events. Now, a decade has passed since publication of To Err is Human by the Institute of Medicine. That report exposed us all to the magnitude of medical error in healthcare. It caused our leaders to reflect on our systems, the systems that guide what we do every day. Reflect on how these systems influence or set the stage for errors to occur. Safety culture was advertised as a key systems-level variable, something that led us to behave the way we do when we interact with our colleagues and patients. Today, well-known organizations like the Joint Commission and the Institute for Healthcare Improvement are fierce advocates for safety culture measurement. Many studies have characterized safety culture in the ICU, ambulatory care, long-term care, and many other settings. But most recently, Drs. Patterson, Huang, Fairbanks, and Wang have adapted a widely used tool for measuring safety culture for use in the EMS setting. The results from that study will soon be available in an upcoming issue of the American Journal of Medical Quality. The purpose of this month's podcast is to add to that study and reach those who may not have the time to read the article or the related literature. We talk with well-known experts, paramedics, agency directors, and representatives from a well-known national EMS accreditation organization, the Commission on Accreditation of Ambulance Services. First, let's hear from the paramedics. Joe, it's been more than 15 years since you were on a truck and caring for patients. When you think about safety back then, what comes to mind?
We were cowboys back then. We would do whatever we had to do to get the call done. I mean, whenever a call went out, not only did the crew show up, but 10 or 15 other people would show up because they wanted to be there too. We would just dive into the car and get people out. One particular time, they called out for a paramedic, and I lived a little further away than most people from our main coverage area, and I wanted to get there quick, so I just jumped on my motorcycle. Wore a helmet, but like a bat out of hell to get to that call first. But we were so excited about getting to the scene of the accident. It was a real wild, crazy show. We were all volunteers back then. We were there because we wanted to be there, and it was the excitement of being on a call. And that kind of overrode any safety things that came up, unfortunately.
Is safety for the patient or the provider any better today? We asked two junior paramedics who are in their early 20s and relatively new in EMS to comment. What comes to mind when you hear the word safety?
Safety, I think, brings in a lot of different aspects. There's obviously patient safety, there's clinical safety, such as while you're actually doing some sort of clinical work, be it starting an IV or intubating. I think there's safety in terms of driving, there's safety in terms of operations, there's scene safety. So I feel like safety is a very, very broad term Yeah, to add to that. I think initially, you know, when you think of safety, of course, you think about ambulance accidents, which is obviously a huge risk, and it's very transparent because when that happens, you know, it goes immediately to the news.
Right.
But of course, the things that sort of stay behind the scenes are, you know, back injuries from improper training. One example that we had at the service that I work for just a few weeks ago was one of the providers had her hand stuck in a stair chair that collapsed and trapped all of her fingers, and she was out of commission for several days due to that.
What are some major threats to safety?
I'd have to say, in the broad strokes, the biggest threat is lack of good training.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'd add the term experience to training, because I feel that where training stops, experience has to come in and fill in the gaps. And our case may be unique to our area. It depends on what sort of service you work for, because we work in a service where each ambulance has one paramedic and one EMT. And so when we feel that the patient's condition is critical enough to warrant ALS care, we have to be in the back of the ambulance, and the EMT is driving. And I'd say a majority of our EMTs currently are not necessarily brand new, but they're very young, they're generally inexperienced, and they haven't even been driving their own personal vehicles that long. So they have less experience with, let's call it, crisis management while driving. They can do the day-to-day driving from point A to point B just fine, but when things start getting a little bit out of hand, when there's traffic, when there's an emergency situation, when adrenaline's running, they deal less competently with that. So I'd agree that probably driving is one of the most dangerous things that I feel we do right now, just driving around, be it with or without a patient. The other major threat I think, or that I feel to my safety, is fatigue. Either my fatigue or my partner's fatigue, or even fatigue elsewhere in the system that means I get incomplete information or what have you. A lot of us work 24-hour shifts or longer depending on where we are, what the circumstances are. And while you are allowed to sleep in general, unofficially, when you're not, you know, doing anything else in terms of chores or paperwork, it seems as though it's frowned upon, especially by some of the older supervisors who feel that you're here, you're getting a paycheck, you should be up. And they would rather have you be awake, staring at a computer screen, playing solitaire, than asleep, which doesn't make much sense to me, especially when you're on a 24-hour plus shift, because, you know, What are you gaining from playing solitaire and being up? And so I think that's a major threat. The fatigue of either myself or my partner causes errors, causes lapses in judgment.
Well, certainly I think that on that subject of fatigue, that is a big risk. You know, if you come in on a Saturday, and I typically work 16-hour shifts, my partner works at three different ambulance services, and he has just gotten off shift within 4 hours of being on for, you know, maybe 24 hours at that service. So he's compromised with his amount of sleep that he's had. I'll drive the ambulance to any call that we go on, but the fact of the matter is, if it's an ALS patient, and they typically are, I can't drive. He's an EMT. He has to drive. I have to be in the back. So I've got somebody that's, compromised, deprived of sleep, that's up in the front seat, that's relatively new, maybe has only been an EMT for the last year or so. And, you know, I think that that's a big risk. Turnover is a huge threat for us. It's a huge threat individually with our company, but in general, I think in the industry, it's a big problem.
New providers aren't taught how to communicate well, especially with older providers, I think. That's something that some of us learn either from prior experiences in other fields or just from, you know, learning on the job. But new providers are taught very well how to speak with patients.
What comes to mind when you hear the word culture?
I think as a broad term, workplace culture means the, in general, implicit set of standards that are espoused by a group of people at work in a given place. It may come from administration. It may come from the more senior people that have worked somewhere for a longer period of time. But it's generally the unwritten rules that may or may not follow the official policies and procedures on how a person should be behaving.
They only basically find out what needs to be done and what's expected of them by word of mouth.
individual culture of that company. And then there's probably a regional culture and, you know, even farther outside of that. But, you know, within this region, you know, for example, there's certain services that put everybody on the stretcher.
When you first walked into your organization, was the culture of that organization visible? Was it immediately apparent what the norms were or what the implicit rules were or the ways of doing things?
No, it wasn't immediately evident. I wouldn't say that. We eat our own young in EMS. And if you can tough it through and have a thick skin, then you'll likely make it. But in the beginning, you're generally disliked because you're just not aware of the neighborhoods. You don't know how to get to where you need to go, maybe not aware of how to get to the hospitals and just sort of the ins and outs of the company, you know, what you need to do, whether you need to do, you know, sort of menial tasks like laundry and the dishes in the kitchen, or make sure your truck's properly stocked. So there's a lot of subtle pressures to the provider.
With all these threats out there, what makes you feel safe, and what do you do every day to be safe?
I would say that I come in for patient safety. I make sure that the ambulance is completely stocked with absolutely everything that it needs. That's the number one priority when you come into the station. It's not washing the truck. It's not pouring yourself a cup of coffee because you don't know when you're going to get the call. It could be in 5 minutes or 3 hours. So it's your responsibility. It is your responsibility to not be negligent, and you should have that internal feeling, you know, of altruism, that feeling of, you know, having a duty to the patient that, you know, you have everything that you need.
It's a difficult question. I think the most safe thing we do is probably the protocol-based treatments. There's issues when protocols are administered incorrectly or when they're followed incorrectly, where, you know, you used either the wrong protocol for the wrong patient or you followed what you thought was the protocol but did it wrong. If I'm familiar with my partner, then I don't really need to speak to them about it. But if it's someone that I've never worked with before, I find it's usually a good idea anyway, outside of safety, but even just for clinical and operations, to sit down with, you know, your new partner and say, hey, you know, just so we can get this through before we go on a call, this is how I generally do things. This is what I do. This is what I don't do. What do you do? What do you like? What do you dislike? Because for every task, there are thousands of different ways to do it that are all correct, but everybody does them differently. And when you have two different methods going on a call, then, you know, conflict develops, and conflict isn't good for you or for the patient, whether it be active, you know, anger conflict or simply just two people not meshing very well. And so talking through that before maybe before the start of the shift, or, you know, right at the start of the shift, I think helps a lot in terms of establishing some sort of safety culture for the two of you for the shift.
Thinking about resources, it ties indirectly into safety, but if you need a resource as a practitioner, as an EMS practitioner on the street, by and large, you get it. It's like, listen, we need the police down here now, or we need a rescue truck, or we need the fire department over here. They tie into safety. I'd say that the resources that are made available to us are an aspect of what can make it safer.
With so many threats to your safety and to the safety of your patient, and so many responsibilities and tasks to be safe, why do it? Why work in EMS?
We enjoy serving the community that we serve. It is of great importance to us to give them proper medical care, and I don't think by any stretch of the imagination that they get shortened on that. I think that we provide an extremely high standard of care.
We've heard from some new junior paramedics concerning their views on safety for themselves and for the patient. Now, you've been around for 22 years as a paramedic. You've worked a long time with a lot of different people, and you've seen a lot. What do you feel are the most prevalent threats to your safety and to the safety of your patients?
Vehicle crashes from time to time. We haven't anything all that catastrophic. I think it just kind of ebbs and flows as far as what threats are. I mean, obviously the common ones in EMS are obviously, I think the biggest ones, vehicle safety, safety operating highways. I know needle sticks used to be an issue until we pushed to go to all needle assist. But I think it evolves with the technology and time. I mean, there's a lot of new technology out here now that makes this job a lot safer than it used to be. The you know, the Striker stair chairs, the one-man stretchers, some of the vehicle safety stuff we put in with the drive cams, fluorescent vests. I don't know if I have a specific story that jumps out in safety. I think it kind of just it drifts over time, you know, based on what the technology is and what the attitudes are of the personnel in the field.
Fatigue was mentioned by our younger medics as a potential threat to their personal safety and to the safety of our patients. Here's what our older medic has to say about fatigue.
I don't consider fatigue to be as much of a problem as institutional attitudes. You know, I mean, I don't know, some other systems where they work like 12 or 24-hour shifts, I think that's more of an issue. You know, our system working eights, or if you're on overtime, you're working 16s. I don't think the fatigue factor is as big as an issue. Not that on individual cases that could come into play. I will be, you know, you talk about culture. I think it's more cultural issues is more things I'm concerned about is, you know, are we going to do things in a proper and safe way or are we not? And I think that varies from organization to organization.
What about culture? One junior medic used the phrase, "We eat our own young in EMS," meaning we give our newest DMTs and medics a hard time early on, maybe to toughen them up a little bit to see if they can hack it in the long term. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think it applies to the organization, obviously, just the general kind of way of doing business of the organization. I mean, there's an organization that's, you know, tightly run ship, and we really pay attention to detail and do things kind of by the book. There's a more kind of a loosely run operation, and it comes down to what the individuals in the field feel like doing with minimal oversight. So I think it's more, you know, how the organization conducts itself from that standpoint, kind of the corporate culture, if you want to take it to that level. Yeah, I think it definitely it drifts over time. I know I've seen it drift over time here. It depends on what the leadership is. If you have a lot of new people coming into the organization, if you don't have as many, I think, you know, depending on changes in leadership and having a large influx of new people in the organization over a short time tends to shift the culture somewhat.
Comments from our paramedics raise many questions about safety and the culture of an EMS agency. There are obviously some differences and some similarities in opinions. We ask one EMS director to weigh in and provide us with his perspective.
My name is Bill Minikevich, and I am the director of Calhoun County Emergency Services, which includes the Emergency Medical Service for Calhoun County, South Carolina.
In your opinion, what are some threats to patient safety?
Okay, probably the most prevalent dangers, potential dangers to patients and patient safety in EMS would be first, accidentally dropping a patient when lifting or moving a patient on a stretcher. Another one would be medication errors, dosing errors, either the drugs are drawn up improperly or a mechanical failure of an IV bag drip or using a pump. And also there's a potential with airway management errors, misplaced ET tubes and things like that.
Promoting safety isn't an easy job for an agency director. It's a little bit like a labor of love.
Safety is very, very important to me. It has been an uphill battle because a lot of EMS people, for some reason, their culture is that they don't necessarily want to participate in wearing all of the safety equipment. It becomes cumbersome, especially the helmets. And I always tell my employees that I don't want to have to go to your family and tell them the bad news that you're not coming home because of something that I may have been able to prevent.
Our four paramedics have set the stage for our next guest. They have described their own perceptions of safety and identified some threats to safety. They have described their perceptions of EMS workplace culture and informed us of some steps taken to make their work and the patient a little more safe. We now turn our attention to three extremely experienced, well-respected, and extremely knowledgeable experts on safety culture. We first interview Jim Conway at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement to comment on safety culture. Established in 1991, the IHI is an independent, nonprofit organization that aims to improve the quality and safety of patient care. We ask Mr. Conway to describe safety culture for us.
First and foremost, a culture of trust. It's a culture where we in healthcare, both looking at our own practice, the practice who we, of those we share accountability with, and patients and families, how we come to the table together to deliver this thing that we're allowed to do called care. I think then very quickly it gets into a whole bunch of elements that we can go through in some detail. But first and foremost, it's about trust, it's about respect, and it's about individual and shared responsibility for care.
Next, we ask Mr. Terry Mathis to define safety culture for us. Mr. Mathis is an internationally recognized expert and consultant on safety culture. He is the founder and chief executive officer of the consulting firm ProAct Safety.
First of all, I wrote a book that had that term safety culture in it in 1996, and I got asked the same question. People said, what in the world is safety culture? What world is that? First of all, it's kind of a self-contradicting term because culture is something that's common to a group of people, not a theme or a topic. So when you say safety culture, what you're really talking about are the safety aspects of a culture. Safety culture to me is a combination of things. Some of the people say, well, culture is what people do when they're not being watched. Culture is really more the reason why people do what they do when they're not being watched, but it's also the reason why they do it differently when they are being watched, because being watched can be a part of the culture, and management or supervision can actually be a contributing factor to what ultimately the safety culture is. And some of the characteristics of it that I think are especially important are, you know, what are common practices? And within these common practices, do people have a sense of vulnerability? Do they recognize some of the low probability risks that are present in some of the everyday things that they do? And do they have a healthy respect for these things? And then also, you know, what are the organizational pressures? Does the organization influence people to be safe, or does the organization influence people to rush and get the job done regardless of the safety aspects of what they're doing? Walking up to a person and saying, that's not the safe way to do the job, do it this way, isn't necessarily going to be effective if the reason they do it that way is external or organizational or environmental. So I think culture is understanding what common practice is in safety and why it's that way.
We also spoke with Dr. Deb Potter of Potter & Associates Consulting, a safety consulting firm.
I've talked to leaders who understand the concept of organizational culture, but never really thought about a safety culture. So in some respects, there's a lot of education to do. For those that do understand that there is a safety culture, I think the common thread is that it's all about helping workers go home every day without injury. Different companies handle or view safety culture in different ways. Some look at safety as an add-on to their business processes, that it's just almost an afterthought.
Why not just focus on rate of injuries, rate of errors, or number of missed intubations? Why consider safety culture measurement? Terry Mathis tells us why.
Those measures are good, you know, and first of all, we're not touting that you should substitute culture for all those measures. But to a large degree, like Norton and Kaplan discovered in the balanced scorecard approach to strategic management, those metrics are results metrics. You know, and so your goals very often are harbored in those results metrics, but those results metrics don't tell you how to get better. They just tell you if you're getting better, if you're getting worse, if you're staying the same. They're not prescriptive. So how do you get there? You know, and safety culture is one of those tools that not only can help you improve those numbers out there on the back end, but culture, as I view it, is a sustainability tool. It can show you 500 ways to improve safety in the short term. The problem is they're programs, and they have a plan beginning and end, and they have a short-term impact. Culture, if done correctly, is a long-term sustainability tool. So once you get something really firmly rooted in a culture, not only does it work, but it lasts. And in today's world, sometimes the sustainability is a bigger challenge than even making it successful short-term.
Once again, Jim Conway from the IHI.
You know, one of the very striking statistics I learned a few years ago when I was on an Institute of Medicine committee that was looking at medication safety is the committee projected that 50% of medication errors occur at transition points. I can't think of anybody who is more at the heart of a transition point than an EMS worker. Patient safety is a fundamental part of the delivery of any system. If you were to go to a nuclear power plant, you couldn't, as a staff member, decide you weren't going to go to the safety lecture. It's a fundamental property of any system. So what emergency medical services needs to do is look to see how they can create the space to allow individuals to learn more about this area called patient safety.
Many listeners may have questions about safety standards and what those standards look like or how they are evaluated in EMS. The easy yet scary answer is they vary. We are honestly uncertain exactly how variable safety standards are across the 17,000 plus EMS and first response agencies that serve our nation. What we can do is learn about safety standards from national EMS accreditation bodies such as the Commission on Accreditation of Ambulance Services.
My name is Sarah McEntee. I'm the Executive Director for CAS, and CAS stands for the Commission on Accreditation of Ambulance Services. CAS is an independent, not-for-profit organization that was established in the early 90s to promote quality in the EMS industry. Currently, CAS has 135 accredited agencies across the United States, Canada, and the West Indies, representing 37 U.S. states.
What does CAS accreditation say about an agency?
Accreditation signifies that an agency has met the gold standard of care in the EMS industry. The CAS standards are comprehensive and serve as a template for a quality organization.
What is an example safety standard for CAS accreditation?
CAS has very specific safety standard requirements for all aspects of the business. For example, with respect to safety restraints, CAS has a very specific policy stating that an agency shall have written policies, procedures addressing safety restraints. At a minimum, these policies and procedures must include required use of seat belts for everyone in the front of moving vehicles, required use of seat belts for everyone in the patient care compartment, including your patients, unless that's impractical to providing patient care, use of safety, child safety seats, securing of all equipment in a moving vehicle, and safety restrictions for front seat passengers in vehicles equipped with passenger side airbags. Too often, safety is just a sidebar to an organization. It's something that they feel they have to do. They have to have a safety a safety person. They have to have a safety committee. They have to. It's a requirement, and it's viewed as a requirement and not as something that they embrace as part of their whole operation.
Only recently has a study examining safety culture in EMS been published. That study highlighted variations in safety culture across EMS agencies. Culture, as it has been defined and described by our interviewees, is something more than the official policies and procedures of an organization. It is too early to know if an EMS agency that puts itself through the rigors of national accreditation truly exemplifies a high safety culture. As we learned from our interviewees, safety culture fluctuates over time. It is not static. In general, safety culture is a barometer, an indicator of the current state of affairs relative to safety. As Dia Gaynor said, we must, as an industry, adopt a culture of safety, not just for our patients, but for our own safety.
To learn more about MSARN or to leave feedback on our podcast, log on to www.msarn.org. For MSARN, my name's Charlie Warner, and I'm just an ambulance driver. Thank you. Good day.